Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is March 13th, 2025, and this is episode 508. I am the co-host Mark Ames. I am in the greater Rochester area of northwestern New York, soon to be a border battleground with our great neighbors to the north. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe, please, at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And speaking of Warnerds, I'm on the line with the Warnerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in Puglia, in the heel of Italy. How's it going there, John?
Pretty good, but I think you'd better watch out for Irish-American veterans of the Civil War. They tend to cause trouble around Niagara Falls. I don't know if we've done a show about it, but they actually did stage an armed invasion of Canada, The Fenians, and I think they won their first battle, but you know, after that it was not so good.
Well, they battled the British, right? I mean,
right. The Ontario militia, more like.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is something maybe we should do sometime in the near future. What would happen if we were to invade? Because Greenland just held a vote yesterday, and Trump and Musk were trying to apply a lot of pressure. You know, Greenland, you're having a vote. You could vote to join us. It would be beautiful. We'll do beautiful things. Very rich. We're a big country. And, of course, they did not vote to trade in their free first-class Denmark universal health care for America's world's shittiest and most expensive health care. I mean, I don't know what's going on with them, but they didn't trade it in.
They must be crazy.
They must be absolutely crazy, I know. Yeah, there was a poll of Greenlanders, and 85% of them, strangely enough, said that no way did they want to join the U.S. And then there was a certain amount of undecided, and then 5% said that they wouldn't mind considering the possibility of joining America, which I consider a pretty low percentage, because there's always 5% of people who want to wreck everything, including themselves, as you would say, John, who want to call
absolutely
an airstrike on
like
their own neighborhoods.
Bring it all down.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I feel that way kind of frequently.
Yes, I think a lot.
Not
of
as often as I did in the old days, but, you know, yeah. I get a little nostalgic twinge every now and then for the mushroom clouds.
Yeah. And I consider it pretty low, considering that 14% of Canadians said they would be willing to entertain being annexed, or willing to be annexed by America. And
well, I can tell you, I think, what most Canadians would say about that. It's like, oh, that's Alberta. Or it's, you know, everybody who got pissed off at the Margaret Atwood crowd in Ontario and is willing to call in an airstrike on their neighborhood just to shut them up. And that's sizable.
Yeah. It's strange. We're also seeing, waves of kind of Canadian nationalism from the threats that I hadn't seen before. And Doug Ford, who's kind of, you know, the quasi-Trump of the Trump A of he's the governor, whatever they call it, the governor.
Yeah, he's the
of Ontario.
Surviving Ford brother.
Yes, yeah.
The sane one.
Yeah. And he's kind of taking the lead in it, since nobody takes anything Justin Trudeau says seriously. So he's kind of taking the lead in fighting back. But yeah, no, 14% sounds like we're getting more towards American numbers. I think the American numbers of willing to call in airstrikes is probably closer to 40% of those willing to bomb their own neighborhoods. And I have variously been part of that 40% at various times in my life. I'm not going to say when. But
don't get me started.
Exactly, yeah. So yeah, that the vote did not go very well for the Trump expansionists, and I don't expect it to go their way for Canada. I don't, you know, the only way to take any of these places if the Trumpists are serious is through invasion. It's not going to happen through democratic means, anything close to democratic means, and they're not going to invade, I don't think. So
No. They'd have to have a global war break out and occupy them for their own good and then not leave. But, you know, the U.S. empire perfected a way of doing that without offending most of the countries involved, all except Okinawa, for example, because they couldn't keep the Marines in control on Okinawa. But most of the countries, the U.S. presence never left, and people were sort of more or less grudgingly okay with it.
Yeah, Trump got rid of the soft power, the whole soft power arsenal, because a lot of that was, we've talked about this, was aimed at undermining the kind of the MAGA political project indirectly or directly. And so the whole thing had to go, apparently.
Yeah.
But I do expect we should just be on the record. It's, although there are some conservatives who just genuinely do oppose all of that regime change interventionism, my guess is for Trump himself and Rubio and the other sort of the top level of the MAGA, they're going to revive that. But it's just that the soft power is going to be the sort of soft power that meshes nicely with MAGA and, you know, neoconservative or not, I don't know what you call it, whatever their right-wing values are. So that so that the soft power being spread around the world is going to be the sort of soft power that boosts, you know, Trumpism at home and in allied countries as well. That's my guess. So today we wanted to catch up again, because so much is going on a few World of War items, a lot of stuff going on. We have coming up, we're going to be doing, John's going to do an episode on the British Navy mutiny in 1798. I know people have been excited about that. We will be doing that soon, and we have some other great stuff coming up. But we got to get this stuff out of the way because a lot's going on. So let's start off with the Columbia grad student, green card holder, Mahmoud Khalil, who was disappeared basically by ICE agents, and the White House, Trump administration posted this gloating photo saying shalom, which is all these things are just going to be doing wonders for diaspora Jews. You know, Israel loves this, but all this is bad for American Jews, diaspora Jews to be.
Yeah, a lot of that are saying that now, like, you know, this is just a bummer.
Yeah. So apparently there's kind of a fight over who actually set Khalil up, who basically ratted him out. A lot of people think the infamous Shahid Davidi, who's this Columbia, I don't know, business professor weirdo who stalks all the kids all the time and tries to film himself getting victimized and tries to always get people arrested or in trouble. Either him, he's a very strange, unbalanced character. And then there's Betar, this weird Kahanist group that we talked about, I think, briefly on the show before, because these were the guys who tried pinning a pager on Norm Finkelstein. They also have taken credit, I think, for Khalil's getting arrested and disappeared. They were founded, of course, their executive director is Ross Glick, who the New York Post had called the revenge porn king. Great guy. just lovely people, all of them. Yeah. One thing that was kind of funny about this, you know, first of all, as a lot of people pointed out, the whole sort of Trump online infrastructure was very self-righteous about being for free speech, against wokeness. We're the ones against censorship. You know, it's wokesters and liberals who are all doing all the censoring, and there's obviously some truth to that. And all of them to a T, or 99% of them, except for people like Greenwald, are absolutely supporting this. And they're saying, oh, this is different. This isn't speech when he comes out, you know, in favor of or against the genocide and protesting for Palestine. This is actually terrorism. This is different. It's always different, you know, when you want to.
I saw somebody saying, oh, no, 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 they disrupted classes. Like, are you kidding? Yeah. You know what happened when somebody disrupted classes? I remember the Revolutionary Communist Youth Brigade marching in with dowels. I swear to God, dowels, which they held at Port Arms into classrooms. And it was like a bored photo op for a while, and then they marched out and everybody got back to the class.
Yeah, they were trying to get arrested. Nobody bothered with them by that time, you know. Yeah. So a lot of the supporters they loved it. I mean, they were gloating. They loved it. This was pure red meat. And, you know, people were saying, like, there was an account, End Wokeness, I think it's run by Jack Posobiec, gloating over it too. And people were like, this is ultra wokeness. I mean, like Israel is your woke. But, you know, as I think we've been trying to say on the show, because you and I came out of the right, I think we had a better grasp. I mean, it was many years ago, but it's still in me. Like, I still know in my guts what's going on. What they always meant was, we want to stomp you. When it says, and wokeness is everything I hate and everyone I hate. And wokeness means end everyone I hate and end everything I hate. That's it.
The grudge predates any particular argument they advanced in favor of the grudge. And all those arguments are disposable. If something they like happens and it seems to contradict some of their stated values. In fact, when, you know, New York Times writers and readers act surprised at this, you have to wonder, are they that dense or are they just pretending?
I think they're scared, and so they want to pretend they don't really understand what's going on. It genuinely scares them, and the reason it scares them is because they know that they should stand up, but they're afraid. Maybe you wouldn't be surprised how many people are afraid of standing up for him, especially in academia, particularly in academia. Like, it's...
I posted a tweet, in fact, or our Facebook post about when I actually heard conveyed to me in deep seriousness by someone who really did have my best interests at heart, but finally decided, look, you're out of control. He said, nobody wants trouble. And he said this in this deeply serious way.
You're talking about with you, or are you talking about the Columbia journalism professor?
No, I'm talking about with me.
Okay, wow. Yeah, wow. Because this was just reported, a Columbia journalism professor telling students that basically their only option was to censor themselves. And this is a guy who's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and that no one was really going to come to their aid. He said, if you have a social media page, make sure it is not filled with commentary on the Middle East, unquote. He told the gathering in Pulitzer Hall.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I mean, that's the state of... These people, ultimately, like, they were so loud and boisterous and self-righteous in Trump 1 because they knew he was weak. He was, you know, his presidency was pretty weak. He didn't have his own party behind him. The whole, you know, the intelligence agencies were aligned with the centrists and the Democrats, saying that he was a Russian puppet. So they felt tough going into press conferences and making Trump look bad and then tweeting about how they're victims of censorship.
But I mean, these are the people who worshipped Anna Politkovskaya.
Yeah.
You know, when she basically gave her life to try to publish what she thought of as the truth. And but Serena Shim, another journalist trying to cover the victory of the YPG in northern Syria, was killed by Turkish intelligence. Mm-hmm. That was even more thoroughly shut down because she was killed by one of our allies who, in fact, drove a truck right into her car in the streets of, where was it? I think Kamishli, maybe? A town just over the border in Turkey.
then we even have National Public Radio, NPR, which is, you know, the voice of liberal higher educated America. They were just, somebody leaked this to the Semaphore guy who does media, Max Tanney, who does some good stuff, that the executives dissuaded one of its most visible gay employees from attending a corporate LGBTQ pride event because the Trump administration was putting pressure on the broadcaster and they didn't want to be seen as being woke. It's getting...
That's extraordinary. I thought that was like somewhat hands-off among the American elite by this point, but I guess not. Anything can be rolled back.
They're selling out, and this is liberals for you, and this is, again, one thing I can say, the big difference between the right and liberals and a lot of the left is that the right sticks by through thick and thin, its side, and the liberals definitely don't. And especially now, as liberals are the party of the status quo, they'll sell out everybody to hold on to their piece of the status quo. And
it's a smaller piece, and they know that. And they're quite comfortable with that because it's still a piece. I mean, that kind of explains what happened with the Democratic Party voting to censure one of their own who dared to speak up against Trump.
Yep. Somebody pointed out as well that when Mahmoud Khalil was disappeared, all of these apologists and supporters online were saying, it's because he supported terrorism. He did this because of terrorism. It's not for speech. And then the Trump administration came out and said, no, it has nothing to do with anything he did illegal. It's what he said. It's just, we're doing this because we don't like him. They were very explicit. That was at
least even that is seems like a malignity for its own sake.
Yes.
But no, it sets a very broad precedent. Like, again, as you say, it's like, what are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. We don't like this guy. He's gone. What are you going to do about it? Well, if there's no, you don't understand. We just don't like him. He's gone. What are you going to do about it? And as you say, crickets.
Yeah. And, you know, who's supporting it? The Anti-Defamation League, a lot of Israelis, a lot of hardcore Zionists. And what is interesting, Corey Robin just pointed this out, and then we'll get on to some more stuff. So Trump is apparently basing this, or the legality of it, on the 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act, which was one of those laws like the McCarran Act, that were passed in the high McCarthy era.
Yeah, you just get the date and you can realize what was happening.
And at that time, this law was passed to get rid of lefties. And a lot of lefties were Jewish immigrants, including Holocaust survivors. And so at that time, Jewish groups were very against it. The bill was called the McCarran-Walter Act, and Francis Walter, who was one of the sponsors of that bill, said one of the goals in passing it was, quote, to expose the Jewish influence on American politics and culture. And now you have these, and the ADL at that time said it was an example of the worst kind of legislation, discriminatory and abusive of American concepts and ideals. And today they're completely in support of using that to disappear or imprison a legal resident, Mahmoud Khalil. And there will be more. There will be more of this. And, you know, unfortunately, we just don't have any opposition in this country either.
No, that's been really striking. And I don't know. I've read stories in the establishment press which suggest the Democrats are playing a deep game. But every time you hear that, it's a deep game. You know, it's five-dimensional chess or whatever. It turns out, no, it was just cowardice. It was just stupidity.
Cowardice, and I think it's pretty clear. The Democrat donor class and the sort of the party network elites, they support a lot of this. I mean, they supported the whole police crackdown on anti-Palestine protesters. They blame anti-genocide protesters, pro-Palestine. They blame them for losing the election.
Yeah.
You know, they are pissed that their base has turned against them on Israel. They're very pissed about it because they see that as a big problem, because that puts distance between their base and their donors. And so I think they support it. They know it's not politique to support it publicly, but the Democrats, the so-called opposition, put together a letter, a public letter to oppose, you know, in defense of Mahmoud Khalil, and only 14 congresspeople signed it.
Yeah, only 14 Democrats. I mean, although you do have to spare a hostile thought for all the free speech libertarians on the right who also didn't sign it. I mean, I can't say that for sure, but I'm willing to bet that maybe one or two of them signed it. Maybe not.
Well, this was Congress. No, it's a good question. I don't know. I think maybe this was meant to be a Democrat thing. I mean, I wonder if Thomas Massie, where he is on this. I don't know.
Yeah.
He's the sort of the new Ron Paul. He's actually pretty good on a lot of
things. Yeah, sometimes he says good things.
He's smart. I'm sure his domestic politics would be pretty awful, but he's pretty much down the line libertarian on anything to do with empire and, you know, tax on privacy. So I don't know. What was that line by Solzhenitsyn I've been quoting him lately, not because I think we're, you know, about to be victimized by a Bolshevik revolution, but it just some of his lines are pretty good. Again, from the Red Wheel, it was, he's kind of channeling the mind of one of the SRs or Bolsheviks. And this is like after 1905, after the crackdown starts by Stolypin. And he says it was, a terrible age, a vile age, an age of reptiles. This really feels something like that. Anyways. Moving on to Ukraine, because this has been a pretty big story, and it was kind of quashed. I think they're finally talking about it. But the big Kursk bulge, which Ukraine carved out last August to great fanfare in the West, a lot of great press, cheers.
No particular strategic reason behind it.
No.
Just grab a bunch of Russian territory.
That was lightly defended, sort of like, you know, again, like the Kharkiv, but that made a lot more sense because that was Ukrainian territory.
Yeah,
they took about 500 square miles. So this was a huge amount of territory for, you know, for this war and for Ukraine to take. I mean, it was very lightly guarded, and it did cause a headache. The strategic goals, as far as we could see, well, we all know the real strategic goal was to get good PR because the Ukraine war had been nothing but a bummer, and they were falling off the map. They were no longer the belle of the NATO ball, and they were trying to make themselves look viable again. And in that sense, in the PR sense, it definitely worked for a good month or two. There were other goals like seize and hold territory to trade during a peace deal so that they could hold it and trade it. I always thought that was absurd. There was no way Putin was going to stop the war until he took back all of the Kursk land. He was, you know, it would not fit in with everything we've seen, the sort of the strategy and psychology. Another theory was to get some POWs. That sort of worked. A brief morale booster. Yeah, that worked briefly. But the cost has been enormous to Ukraine. I mean, the Russians were able to kind of surround and sanitize, cordon off this bulge within a few weeks so that it didn't expand any further. And they kind of turned it into a killing zone.
What happens with pockets.
Yes.
Yeah. Especially when, as a lot of pro-Ukraine mainstream news sources have said, the Trump administration cut off all intelligence.
Yeah.
Their excuse is, well, we cut off intelligence, it's Trump, he's doing it. But I'm not sure that would really explain this complete collapse.
No. So, apparently, you know, there were some North Korean troops introduced there. Now, the propaganda we get is that there were between 10 and 15,000 and that half of them apparently were killed or wounded. And it, despite that, of the battlefield not being littered with bodies, they were, there are apparently, they came up with a couple of fake North Koreans to try to prove that they existed. And then I think they eventually came up with two that a lot more people said, well, this could be real, two POWs. That seemed a bit more valid. My own take on the North Korean thing is I think there's a kernel of truth to it and that it's just been massively blown out of proportion.
I mean, it's very, very rare that any operation takes puts 50% of your troops into the casualty corner. I mean, that's a last suicide stand statistic.
Yeah. There was so much bullshit coming out about it. Like, for a while, the Ukrainians were saying the reason we're not taking any of them is because every single one of them has been instructed, has been robotically programmed to blow themselves up with a massive grenade so that there isn't even a chunk left of them. And that's why, even though we've come across thousands of bodies, like, they've all been blown to bits. So there was a lot of bullshit like that. But that said, I heard not even just, you know, from various news sources I follow, but even from some people I knew in Russia who went near the war zone, that you know, a lot of people were talking about North Koreans being there, North Koreans basically testing out assaults. That doesn't mean it definitely happened, but I do trust those sources. Mm. They've been pretty right to me in the past. So I like I said, I think there's a kernel of truth, not to the casualty figures, but I just think there's a kernel of truth to the whole story. I just think it's massively exaggerated.
North Korea is a pretty ruthless regime. And one thing that really can't be taught so much is combat experience.
Yes.
And they can't really do it except in special operations on the South Korean border because, you know, yeah, nuclear holocaust,
That's a
makes
problem.
My life a living hell. but they can try some troops out, try some different weapons out, techniques.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I think is what happened. In any event, the Ukrainians put a lot of their best forces who were frustrated being stuck in trench, in just, you know, attritional trench warfare that was going badly. So they put a lot of these guys into the Kursk operation and a lot of really good equipment. And slowly the Russians were eating it away, chunk by chunk. But really in the last few weeks, it has been collapsing at a much faster pace. And I started seeing video and images coming out of Ukraine-occupied Kursk that showed there's one main road that goes to Suja. Suja is the main town in this pocket that Ukraine held. And Suja has strategic value because it's also an important gas pipeline transit point. So they really wanted to hold on to Suja. And I saw video and pictures of this roads that they use to deliver logistics equipments and people back and forth and take out wounded. And the roads were just full of blown up, burned out armor and regular vehicles that they use to try to outrun the drones. They've been getting picked off by drones, and the Russians really advanced to another level with drone warfare, particularly in Kursk, and were able to pretty much neutralize the HIMARS. I mean, they figured out the HIMARS. The HIMARS are still very effective, but the Russians did, like, massively reduce the effectiveness of the HIMARS going back even 2 years. I think this is one of the reasons that the Americans started getting wary about giving their best equipment to the Ukrainians because it was getting figured out. But the roads were just that dangerous. I remember, I think it was a German television crew just a few weeks ago went with some Ukrainians. They went, you know, they met up sort of in the Sumy Oblast in the north of Ukraine on the border with Kursk. And then They went in two cars with a bunch of troops in the two cars to go into occupied Suja. This is still when the pocket was much larger, to do some reporting from within. And they got attacked by drones in the middle of the night. And one of the cars got into an accident trying, I think it got hit partly by a drone, and the car got taken out. And so the journalist in that car fled into the woods and was just terrified, and they couldn't do a rescue mission for that journalist until the next day. The other car turned around and went back into Ukraine. And you see in that video from a few weeks ago just how much equipment had already been taken out. And what happened a few days ago, about 5 or 6 days ago, I guess, from the time we're recording this, there was this incredible operation. And, you know, wherever you stand on Russia, it's, you know, it is an illegal invasion. They're in the wrong for invading Ukraine and all that. But this was an amazing operation that Russian forces did. They basically did a sewer rat operation to get into Suja. They trained their forces to crawl in this gas pipeline, which was about 1.5 meters high. They had to crawl for 15 kilometers. I think it took a few days.
Wow.
They first had to turn off everything, clear it of methane, and then pump in oxygen. And they also put provisions at different points and did practicing along the pipeline. And then these guys, made their way over a couple of days. And
you would have had to camp out in the...
Yeah. Yep.
In the tunnel. Wow.
Yep. And then they popped up in Suja and surprised the Ukrainians. And they timed it as they popped out with an assault from about three different, angles into Suja. And the Ukrainian forces completely collapsed what were there. And so the Russians were able to take Suja. So at this point, there's nothing really of value being held by the Ukrainians, and I think the Russians are mostly doing cleanup at this point. And Putin is now talking about seizing a sort of buffer area in the Sumy Oblast of Ukraine. But yeah, that's terrifying, I think.
The impact of drones on armored vehicles clearly has to be thought through by people designing vehicles and methods of attack over the next decade, because you can't armor a lot of vehicles to resist drones, especially when they attack from above, where most armored vehicles have their lightest covering. You have to protect the two parts that are very difficult to defend, the roof and the tires or treads. You can build a tank that will resist a lot of weapons, anti-tank weapons, but as Ukraine found out in the last attempt at an offensive, you can't really build a tank that will resist all anti-tank mines because they can just build them as big as they want. And you can't design rapid advance vehicles that have, light armor against 7.6-millimeter ammunition that will also resist a drone.
You know, both sides in this war have really rapidly innovated in drone tech and drone warfare and electronic anti-drone warfare. It's been a sort of rapid Darwinian evolution.
Yeah. But one I think if we haven't mentioned it before, which we may have, you should all read a Philip K. Dick story, Third Variant.
Yes. Yeah. But one thing the Russians came up with, or at least fielded late last summer, and I think if I remember right, it was first really fielded. So in the fall, in response to Ukraine taking that Kursk bulge, was fiber optic drones. So it can't be jammed because it's on a wire. It's on this really super thin wire that's really, really long. And so they were able to get, fire control over the roads. Well, first they were able to chew away more quickly without taking big casualties on their own side, chew away at the Kursk Bulge and then get fire control over the one main road in from further away than normally, and really with devastating effect. And they still, as far as I know, the Ukrainians still haven't really, like the Ukrainians have been complaining, as have the NATO world, about we got to do something about these fiber optic drones because there's nothing, it's very hard to counteract them, unlike drones that are working off a frequency or GPS or whatever.
Well, yeah, I mean, this started with the TOW missile. It unwinds a long, very thin wire. And yeah, you can't interrupt the signal because the signal is coming over from the wire. So Soviet doctrine was pretty simple and probably would have been effective. It was find the launcher and blow it up, because if you can disrupt the missile before it hits you, it probably will veer off. So I don't know if it's the Army doctrine, but Marine Corps doctrine anticipated a 90% casualty rate on TOW launcher crews.
Yeah, because it's pretty straight, right?
Yeah.
The line on the wire is pretty straight, so it's kind of easier to find where it came from. The thing about these drones is, like, they'll spin around and up and down trees. It's the fact that it's wire doesn't stop it from maneuvering as if it's not on wire. I don't fully get how it's done. I would imagine sometimes it gets tangled. But this is a lot of it's kind of forested area, and these drones nevertheless work really well.
I think we've both seen a very, very terrifying video of a Russian soldier, in this case, trying to clamber through a mass of timber and wreckage just to get away from a drone, and it gets him eventually. Yeah.
And it looks like the gamer who's operating the drone is having fun. Doing it. And you see that from both sides. You see that with Russians doing that to Ukrainians. Hey, anyway, I hate this war. Samuel Bendett, friend of the show, previous guest, who's a real expert on Russian and Ukrainian drone warfare, he did a thread quoting from a Russian military blogger who talked about the role that drones played in basically collapsing this Kursk Bulge. I want to read just a little bit of it here. It's kind of interesting. He says here, as their troops are moving, getting towards Suja and the village of Novinkoye, there's video footage appeared from the Sumy-Suja highway, which I talked about, with a bunch of burnt out Ukrainian equipment. Then the information field exploded with Operation Truba. Truba is pipeline, so that means the operation of the special forces going through the pipeline. To summarize, it can be said that the Russian army has mastered a tactical technique of, quote, isolating the battlefield, unquote, by modern means and modern conditions. With the help of drones, the supply of the Ukrainian forces was cut off and they had no options but to retreat. A de facto cauldron was created for the Ukrainians, which was closed not by living soldiers but by robots, which sharply reduced our losses, did not allow Ukrainians to counterattack at the moment of the cauldron's close, and it was possible to greatly thin out their battle formations during their escape, almost completely destroy their armored vehicles and transport. And it was due to the quantity and quality of their drones. And he said a lot has changed even since 2023. And these were good Ukrainian forces. I saw where the commanding general, Gerasimov, of the Russians claimed that 41% of Ukrainian armored equipment that's been destroyed in, the last couple months, or maybe longer, so in the last couple months, 41% of that was just in the Kursk Bulge. So this has been very, he might be exaggerating, but you can just see from the pictures, it's been a very costly PR exercise. And we on this show have been saying it's going to be a costly PR exercise for a while. Mm. And I think the collapse of the Kursk, bulge and adventure, whatever you want to call it, played a big role in Ukraine kind of changing, Zelensky changing their position on a ceasefire with Trump and actually turn around and say, no, actually, we want a 30-day ceasefire. And that, yeah. that Zelensky changed that position just, you know, in the last couple of days while out in Saudi Arabia with Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State. And it was actually, from a PR point of view, it was probably a smart move because it aligns Zelensky now with what Trump wants. Trump wants a ceasefire. He wants parties to give up a lot, and he wants the ceasefire so he has that notch in his belt. And Ukraine has gone from being the holdout to now being the ones that actually agreed to a ceasefire. And then, of course, every single, there was like a, the ball is in Russia's court. This was like the headline all over everybody's tagline, mm-hmm. but, you know, I guess it's true. And Putin has come out and said, you know, he doesn't oppose it. He's interested. He wants more details. And he wants to add some conditions to the ceasefire. But I'm not really sure how it could hold because Russia went to war to make deep political changes in Ukraine and NATO. And Russia didn't go to war to get a ceasefire. So, right. And especially because they're winning. I mean, you know, the deal that they're going to demand today in 2025, since the war has gone so much better for them in the last 2.5 years than in the first half year, it's not going to be a kind of deal that's going to go over well in Ukraine. So now,
yeah, I can't quite remember. You know this much better than I do. Did Ukraine, if I recall correctly, refuse a deal early in the war when things were going well for them on the advice of their big backers in the West?
So yeah, about a month into the war, the Russians and the Ukrainians sat down for ceasefire talks in Istanbul, secret ones, I think. And sometime into it, one of the lead Ukrainian negotiators, and he was with, I want to say he was with the military intelligence, the GRU, he was murdered by the SBU, the former KGB of the Ukrainians. And then they said it was an accident. But it's very weird, yeah. So what happened in that, we know now. We had heard this for a while, but now we know what happened because a lot of the participants, including in the Ukrainian side, have spoken and documents have been released. The Ukrainians and the Russians came to an agreement. The Russians were going to pull back to where the lines were before the full-scale invasion. So they were going to still hold on to the eastern part of Donbas that they had before the invasion, plus Crimea. And Ukraine was going to agree to neutrality, to change it, so that they wouldn't align with NATO anymore, and that they would federalize, that is to say, they would give more local rights to Russian-speaking regions. Basically, kind of to implement the Minsk deal was pretty much, but more than that, let's say. And they had agreed on that, but then they needed the American backing, some kind of security guarantees or some kind of support. And the Americans said, why stop now? You're doing so well. The Russians are on their back foot. The Americans didn't want to give any kind of security guarantees, and they were so happy with what was going on. They didn't want to stop it. And then Boris Johnson, the prime minister at the time, was tasked by Biden to go out there and personally deliver that message to Zelensky. Keep the war going. You've got them on the run. You guys are kicking ass. I'm blown away. You're heroes. And so, yeah, we sank it then. And there was some talk of maybe trying to get negotiations going in the fall when Ukraine, after the Kharkiv, after they took all that territory, retook it in Kharkiv. And Russia was at kind of its lowest point. And I just remember there was the squad in the Democratic Party. So, you know, the AOCs and Rashida Tlaib and some of these handful of more progressive Democrats issued an open letter. This was like, I don't know, September, October of 2022, saying we call on Biden to start negotiations. We got to end this war. It's dangerous. And they were slammed. They were called traitors. They were destroyed. And what did they do being Democrats? They withdrew the letter and said they completely support Biden and Blinken, and they apologized. And so, yeah, that was
it's strange. Like if there were a few real fighters like FDR among them,
yeah,
it would make all the difference. But then I suppose, you got to think like an evolutionary biologist. Certain kinds of species don't come to be in certain environments. Yeah. And like, you're not going to get someone like that in Congress.
Yeah. So where we're at right now, I mean, you know, on the positive side, like whatever else you say about Trump, if he gets a ceasefire, that's a hell of a lot more than Biden did, you know, very actively. And it's going to make the entire center-left establishment class in Western Europe and the U.S. look just terrible.
Ignorant vampires, who bathe in blood, but, you know, they don't do the spells right, so it doesn't work.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to just a couple more items before we wrap up the show. In Syria, we're going to try and get Cyrus, friend of the show, Cyrus, back on to talk more about what's happening in Syria, what's really gone on in Latakia and Tartus with the pogroms against the Alawites. One thing I will say, just from having some back and forth with him, he confirmed what Grayzone and Max Blumenthal reported, which is that at least 4,000 Alawites have been killed in these pogroms. And that's true because I've seen some people, you know how the whole Syrian revolution, insurgency, dirty war split a lot of the left and the Palestine movement. It's splitting them again in a way. So I saw people who are normally aligned with Max getting really angry that they reported this. But Cyrus, completely separately from that, said he's hearing the same from sources. At least 4,000 killed, many thousands more wounded, and 200,000 displaced. This is huge.
This would be the biggest story of the year if those people came from a different denomination in Syria.
Yeah, but it's are
really
officially
sickening.
Assadists.
I mean, that's all you can say.
It is sickening. And I just have to say, to Max's credit, because I was there, I saw this debate that he had. We talked about it in one of our earlier radio
I remember episodes. That. I've never forgotten that.
I never have either.
What were they doing? They were clicking their fingers at him?
Snapping their fingers when they supported something that Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept said he was very much in favor of the insurgents, of the rebels. And Max's point was the rebels are sectarian reactionaries and they're going to murder. This is basically NATO and Israel wanting to break a longtime unfriendly country and replace it with sectarian right-wing extremists. And he was right. But boy, did they hate him. That was a shock to me because I thought that after the Iraq invasion, everybody had thought like I do, which is always a bad thought like I do, which is let's stop all these interventions. They all go bad. Or after Libya, you know, but the Brooklyn lefty pro-Palestine, a lot of the pro-Palestine crowd, not Ali Abu Nima, but not Max, not a few others, but a lot of them were very much with the Syrian rebels and just savaged Max and Rania Kalik and Ali and so on. But anyway, Max tweeted out a few days ago, you know, along with footage of, you might have seen this, you know, HTS forcing Alawite men to crawl and bark like dogs around corpses. And they were getting beaten and probably executed after the video like the other corpses. Yeah. Max wrote, thinking today about all the trot academic types, Brooklyn-based Intercept and Nation writers and Sorosy professional activists who rabidly denounced me and others for warning this would be the inevitable result of Wahhabi-led regime change in Syria. Where are they now? Well, Charles Lister right now is heading a literally as we speak, as we're recording this, a conference in Washington, D.C. at the Middle East Institute funded by the Gulf dictatorships. It's called Reimagining Syria, a Roadmap for Peace and Prosperity Beyond Assad. Yeah. And it's Charles Lister with the Atlantic Council and something called the European Institute of Peace. And anyway, we'll have more to say about this. But we wanted to say something about Balochistan, where there was this, the Balochistan Liberation Army pulled off this this incredible...
I mean, Balochistan is a topic we're going to have to get to one of these days, because it's a big topic, and it's going to heat up sooner or later. In fact, it probably is heating up now. I mean, Balochistan is just one of those regions that doesn't get much attention. It's part of Pakistan, it's part of Afghanistan, it's part of eastern Iran. Just imagine that somebody spread paint over the southwestern part of Pakistan, the southern part of Afghanistan, and the southeastern part of Iran, and that became Balochistan. It's very unlucky in geopolitical terms to have those borders, and it has been for quite a while. The Baloch were displaced when Pakistan was created, because Pakistan, we must remember, was created in the same year as Israel, and they have a lot in common. They were dominated by a foreign elite that imported itself and took over the country. And the Sindhi, as the Baloch are sometimes called, were a little stunned by this. For a while, they went along with it in terms of solidarity with fellow Muslims who they thought were victimized during the Indian-Pakistani partition. But eventually, they got tired of being excluded from the Pakistani elite. So they've been mounting a slow guerrilla campaign. But then guerrilla campaigns usually start small and get big and finally spectacularly big. And this was probably the most spectacular attack of the Baloch Liberation Army. They bombed a train. If you ever see a train bombed, like, you know, the scenes in Lawrence of Arabia, mm-hmm. we're talking about that. We're talking about an express train with 450 passengers going from Quetta in the south of Pakistan to Peshawar in the far north of Pakistan, along the Afghan border, which is hundreds of miles long there. And it's a very arid region, looks very much like Lawrence of Arabia. But they bombed the train. From the video that was posted, it looks to me like they didn't exactly bomb the locomotive. They bombed one car behind it.
Right.
I don't quite know why.
They might have tried to get the locomotive and got the car behind it. Or maybe not.
Yeah, a matter of timing, you know?
Yeah.
Come on, it's my first try. Give me a little practice. The guy may have hit the trigger a little later, because they supplied, the Baloch Liberation Army, they supplied a video of the bomb going off as the train goes through the wasteland. And then they supplied, helpfully, a video of their command post on a hill overlooking the train. And that was probably where somebody connected a couple of wires and blew up the train. So after that, some passengers were killed, but then the survivors were marched out of the train to be guarded and originally designed to be taken away and held as hostages by the guerrillas. You can see them in the video on the side of the track, just being herded away from the train. But at some point, the Pakistani army decided to intervene. And by all accounts, that was a pretty bloody operation, like killing. The Pakistani army claims they killed, I think, 25 of the Baloch army guerrillas and many, many passengers were killed either by the Pakistani army or the Baloch Liberation Army or both, which is the usual case in a chaotic hostage seizure like this.
Yeah, for more in-depth on the Balochistan insurgencies, we did a Radio Warner at episode 168. I'll post the link on Balochistan insurgencies, doing some history on it with a great guest, These Long Wars, a Karachi-based blogger. And God, man, we recorded that in early 2019. That's a that seems like a that is a long time ago. I was still in New York City back then. Yeah.
Yeah,
I thought we did that more recently, but that was still in.
But as we were saying before we got to this story, a lot of guerrilla wars start small, and there weren't a lot of big Baloch operations. I mean, the traditional move is you get the guns from rural police stations. And then you use the guns to get more guns. And then, because you usually have more volunteers than you have guns. And then finally you stage the big operation. It may be different here because since there are Baloch on the Afghan as well as the Pakistani side of the border, the Pakistani government has argued for a long time that Afghanistan is helping these people. I'm not totally sure about Baloch-Pashtun relations in general because sooner or later every group quarrels with every other in Afghanistan. But I think in general they get along fairly well.
Well, but Pakistan has not been getting along well with the Taliban-led government.
No,
lately, like very much not so. So
yeah, so that could be. So it could well be that they're benefiting from an alliance with the Afghan Taliban.
Right. Okay. I think we can wrap it up here. Thanks again, everyone, and thanks, John and Brendan, and talk to you all again soon.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.